as more of our kids are adulting out of the house, Christy and I find ourselves reminiscing. And probably some of our favorite memories as we look back at 20 plus years of having children is the vacations. Here's a couple. We are in Yellowstone, wearing a vest like good men do. Here, we're up in, this is actually in Oregon, on the Oregon coast, and then this was just recently in Scotland. You know, as we look back at those vacations, it's where you slow down. It's where the pressure's lifted. It's where I think the type of life and the type of person I am, I think my kids just love it when I kind of chill out. When I just take a breath, when I just take a pause, and usually somewhere, somehow, somebody puts together a playlist. I just went back into Spotify and I just started looking at all the different playlists. This one was given to us by John Albright. It was for an Idaho vacation. I had one from John Kopp. I had one from all sorts of different people. And the playlist, you know, the vacation playlist is an eclectic mix, isn't it? I mean, you got worship songs, instrumental tracks, happy sing-alongs. And you know what's fascinating is I hear some of those songs even now. It takes me right back to that vacation thought process. And I immediately smile as my mind is taken back to the togetherness of those trips. Well, Psalm 120 through Psalm 134, it's the songs of ascent. And just like our vacation playlist helped shape the tone and memory of our journey, this list of psalms are like their own playlist. And they function as this spiritual playlist for Jewish pilgrims making their way up to Jerusalem for the required feasts. And these 15 psalms gave voice to the physical strain and the emotional, maybe the emotional longings and the needs and the desires to draw near to God in his holy city. And woven throughout these psalms are themes of pilgrimage and provision, community, and dependence. Psalm 121, the second psalm in this Song of Ascents playlist, is a powerful confession of trust in the Lord's providential care through the pilgrimage. You see, the road to Jerusalem was long, dangerous, and according to Psalm 120, it's full of wild terrain and threats of evil. So from the threats of Psalm 120, Psalm 121 captures the conversation of a pilgrim who lifts his eyes and sees the rugged hills that stand between him and the presence of God in Jerusalem. He says, "I lift up mine eyes to the hills. From whence comes my help?" His response is rich. "My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth." You see, the psalm reminds the pilgrim that no matter what dangers lie ahead, the Lord who is your keeper can be trusted to guard your steps, your life, and your future. No matter what dangers lie ahead, the Lord is your keeper, and he can be trusted to guard your steps, your life, and your future. So this psalm, it unpacks this truth in four invitations that shape how we walk through life with a confident faith, and it starts by calling all of us to look up. We see this in verse 1 and 2 of Psalm 121, look up, your help comes from the Lord. There's a reason why this psalm is one of the most beloved and frequently quoted. I'm with you, Jotham. Driving home, I love going down 700, and then we take a turn on Highland, and right there's a presentation of the Wasatch that you're tempted every single time. Mine eyes look up to the hills. You can picture the pilgrim, whether they're walking north from Beersheba or whether west out of Jericho or south from the Galilee region, the journey with its ups and downs and potential responsibilities of home left undone, everything going on in their brain, and they round a corner or they crest a ridge and they look up, and what stands between them and Jerusalem? These hills. For some, hills in the Old Testament represent help because they're a place of refuge. They're a place to escape. But for others, they represent hardship. And so when the psalmist says, I lift up mine eyes to the hills, is he looking to the hills as a place of refuge or strength? Or are the hills seen as a place of lurking danger where bandits hide and ambushes are set? Perhaps the hills are just another exhausting challenge, one final step of set of climbs before arriving at the goal. Either way, the pilgrim knows this. His help doesn't actually come from the dirt of the hills. His eyes lift beyond the hills, beyond the created world, to the creator of it all. And from a question to confession in just one breath, he confronts his fear and he says, from where does my help come? Look at verse 2. My help comes from the Lord. Notice the literary device in these two verses. He asks the question in verse 1, and he answers it in verse 2 with the exact same phrase, from where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord. He's driving home the point that whether you see the hills as dangerous or deliverance, the true source of safety is the Lord. Do you notice how the Lord is in all caps? That's the translator's way of letting us know that the psalmist is using God's covenant name, Yahweh. This is the name the Lord who brought Israel out of Egypt, made promises to Abraham. It's a personal, it's a relational name, reminding us that God is not distant. He's not generic. Yahweh is the self-existent, self-sufficient God who's faithful to minister to those he loves. It's not just a title. It's a name that calls to mind his steadfast covenant keeping character. And so the psalmist then deepens the statement with a parallel expression. He says, the Lord who made heaven and earth. That line declares that God is not just a helper. He is the sovereign creator. By referring to heaven and earth, he's using another Hebrew literary device called a merism, where he gives two extremes to express the whole. It means God made everything and rules everything he made. The very hills the pilgrim must cross are shaped by God. And since he's their maker, he's their master. And as God's people walk in faithful obedience to their creator, they can be confident he will guide them to safety. You see, he has not brought them this far to lead them now. He hasn't commanded them to head towards Jerusalem three times a year only for him to destroy them. He's their keeper, and he will see them all the way to Jerusalem. So let me ask you, as a Christian pilgrim, let me ask you a question. What are your hills? As you journey towards heaven, what are the hills? What are the obstacles in your life right now? As you're able, I want you to take a pen and I want you to write your obstacles down. I want you to engage for a moment. This is a psalm that I was a touch overwhelmed as we were singing the songs today, because my mind started to flip through the stories that are right here in this audience of people who are struggling, of people who have trials and pain. So let's not just cruise through this as an intellectual exercise. This is a psalm that should hit our affections, and then we should think. So write it down. What are your hills? Could be you're suffering from spiritual fatigue. Perhaps the long road of obedience in the same direction is long. Maybe the ministry that God's given you or just parenting. Maybe you're vulnerable to doubt and discouragement right now. Could be you're feeling the pull of the world. Maybe the distractions, the comforts, and the values of this world are pulling you away from the heart of God. Could be you're carrying some wound of suffering, whether illness, loss, betrayal, grief. Wounds can make us question the goodness of God. It could be that you're lonely. It's amazing. We can be in this crowd and yet feel so alone and unheard. So write down right now, what is one of your hills? Question number two, where are you looking? What false deliverances are you tempted to seek? As you're able, I want you to write down false deliverances right now that are vying for your attention or your affection or are distracting you from seeing what actually can be your hope, which is the Lord. Are you trusting in your intellect or your ability to outthink your obstacle? How many of you have ever seen a problem and you've come up with five solutions before you even ever talk to God? Are you trusting your finances? It could be even this week. You're kind of trying to figure something out, and you logged in and you looked at your finances and you just kind of did a mental accounting and yeah, that's how I'm going to solve my problem. Really? Do you really feel financially secure in this present environment? You trusting your personality? I'll just get through it again. Are you trusting in your physique, your physical strength? Are you trusting in a person? Is somebody on this earth going to be your deliverance? Some organization is actually gonna solve all your problems? Really? No, ultimately, our help must come from the Lord. Yes, he often uses the things of this world. I mean, he uses people and medicine and wisdom and community as a means of grace. But we need to understand something, that true help is ultimately sourced in him. And so that's what I want us to do. I want us to come into contact with our hills and those false deliverances. And then I want us to actually, almost like a liturgy, I want us to walk away from here this morning with an idea. I want us to hear, so where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. And so let's do that together. I'm going to say, where does my help come from? And you as a congregation, you'll say, my help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. So let me say it. Where does my help come from? Hills may loom large, but God is greater still. You see, Psalm 121 shifts our attention from the majesty of God as our creator to the nearness of God as our keeper. So where does my help come from? It comes from the Lord who made the heaven and the earth, right? He's big, he's strong, and yet he walks beside us step by step, every move with faithful care. So first of all, we see that we are to look up, but then we see we're to stand firm, your keeper never sleeps. This is verse 3 and 4. The first two verses of Psalm 121 are written in the first person. They read like a confession from one that's faltering. The pilgrim looks up, faces uncertainty of the journey, and then declares with renewed faith. You know, he looks up and then he goes, my help comes from the Lord. But beginning verse 3, the psalm switches to the second person. It's almost like there's somebody else in the party that's walking with this pilgrim. It's like maybe a priest or a more mature fellow traveler. And now he speaks with words of encouragement, intercession. And now this mentor offers a prophetic prayer. And he says, may he not let your foot be moved, verse 3. It's a plea that the Lord would not allow the pilgrim to stumble or suffer on this treacherous road to Jerusalem. This would be a natural prayer of every worshiper navigating those rocky uphill paths. We've all hiked with somebody, don't point, who should not have been hiking. There's a reason why my wife and five children love to go hiking without me. Maybe this someone has a shaky knee. Yeah, that's my excuse. A rolled anchor. Rolled ankle. It's needing constant help just to take the next step. That's the image here. A vulnerable traveler being given special attentive care from God himself, guiding each step with infinite care. To describe this care, the psalmist produces a word that echoes six times. We see it in verse 3 and 4 and 5, 7 and 8. And in the rest of the psalm, it's the word keep. Keep is a covenant word. It's not a casual word, but it's deeply personal. The Lord is not just a distant observer. He's our keeper. He's our faithful protector. It brings to mind Psalm 12, verse 7, when it says, "You, O Lord, will keep them. You will guard us from this generation forever." So for the focus of Psalm 121 is this ongoing covenantal care of God, watching, keeping, guarding. Think of a parent who's got a child in ICU. And there that parent sits, unmoving, unsleeping, watching every rise and fall of the chest. That's the Lord with you. You see, God's covenantal care never lapses. Verse 3, it finishes, "He who keeps you will not slumber." He never drifts into distraction or nods off in fatigue. In verse 3, it's this prayer of intercession, and then it counters with verse 4. That's this bold statement of certainty. I mean, that's what he means when he says, Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. It's just calling to attention God's vigilance in how that he's unwavering with his covenantal promise to his people. He's this trail guide who never sleeps. So while you rest, he keeps watch. When your foot hits uneven ground, he steadies you before you can slip. He doesn't hike from a distance. He walks every step with you. And this is in such a contrast to the gods of the surrounding nations. In 1 Kings 18, do you remember that dramatic confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal? I mean, it's been a while since I read this. Honestly, I read this week, and I just started laughing because listen to this. It just flat out says it. Elijah mocked them. I like him. He mocked them. He said, "Cry aloud, for he's a god," talking about Baal. "He's a god. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey." You know, sometimes when you read the Bible and you realize they were crass too, that's helpful. A guy from Idaho really identifies with crass prophets. He's on a journey. Perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. His taunts, he's musing. Maybe Baal is lost in thought, distracted, disengaged. Maybe he's relieving himself. This crude suggestion, he's in the restroom. He's on a journey. He's away. He's out of cell phone range. He's unavailable. He's asleep. He's dozing. Can somebody go wake up baby Baal, please? Baal's portrayed as distracted, limited, unavailable, unreliable, everything Yahweh is not. And Psalm 121 affirms the exact opposite. The Lord is never absent. He's never inattentive. He's never off duty. While false gods fail to answer, the God of Israel keeps watch, wide-eyed, fully engaged, protecting his people without interruption or delay. So what keeps you up at night? What fear starts small but spirals till you cannot sleep? Do you remember the time that your body was tired and yet your mind was not? For me, it was just a number of weeks ago. I went to bed carrying a load of anxieties. You know, sometimes worries are small and familiar, but this one I hadn't faced in a long time. I tried the usual things. I listened to an audiobook. I played a sermon. Usually that does it every time, especially if it's Jotham's. That's not in my notes. Why'd I do that to you? I even beat up my pillow a couple times. Nothing worked. Eventually, I begin to pray. It's like that, I don't know, whenever you pray when you're tired, dear Lord, just that repetitive, slow conversation. I'm laying there in the dark, and it was one of those times where I felt like God was actually pressing in. Those fears. It's like, that's not really what's going on, Will. There's fears that are deeper. At first, the fears that seem simple, but as God burrows into them, it's one of those things that you don't even want to go. It's like an old wound, an abscess of doubt, a fear that's been festering under the surface for years. Things like, do you really trust me? Do you really think I'm in control? And the problem with those kinds of pokes, it gets to the real question, which is, do you or have you really trusted me at all? The reason why it gets personal is because when the Lord begins to uncover wounds to the past, the kinds that shape how we think, relate, and protect ourselves, it's like he's touching the very core of our faith. Because you see, at the core of salvation is trusting God. It's believing who he says. It's trusting him to do what he says. And that night, I'm just not so sure that God really is going to do what he says he's going to do. As I started to think about my life and moments of loss and fear and disappointment, I just was like, the narrative of my heart right now is, can I really trust God to be good? Yes, something was happening in my heart. It wasn't dramatic. It was just slowly, quietly, the Lord just begins to bring Psalm 121 back to mind. The very psalm that I've got posted up in my office, this very psalm that I've known I was going to preach for a month, that I've been quoting and repeating over and over for the last 30 days. And there, Psalm 121 is just starting to go through my brain. And it was almost like the Lord is pushing me to the brink with my fears so that he could say, you can sleep because I don't. And there I was, just casting my fears on the Lord, not perfectly, not all at once, but little by little, my fears were beginning to give way to hope. I'm not speaking to you as somebody who's got it figured out. I'm speaking to you as one that's learning to trust God. That's learning that to trust God is that he's watching when I can't feel it. That he's watching when I can't see it. I'm still learning that I can sleep because he doesn't. So let me ask you, what are your fears? Like, get real, Dad. Get real, Gospel Grace. What are your fears? What keeps you up at night? What races through your brain as you drive to work? I mean, what bounces around your head? What anxieties haunt your heart as you try to walk faithfully towards heaven? Do you believe that you can sleep because he doesn't? You can rest because the Lord is your keeper. He never sleeps. Your keeper stands close beside you. So as we look at Psalm 121, it starts with us looking up. It continues with standing firm because our keeper never sleeps, but it also moves to our third point, rest assured, for your keeper stands close beside you. In the next two verses, that's 5 and 6, there's an elaborate emphasis on the personal protection that God gives to his people. Twice we see the covenant name of God. In verse 5 and verse 6, he says, the Lord is your keeper, and the Lord is your shade. So the psalmist is drawing together the big truth that your creator, the covenant-keeping God who guards Israel, is also the one who guards you. And this isn't just general care. It's intimate, specific, and personal. The Lord's not just a keeper. He's your keeper. The image of shade on your right hand, verse 5, personalizes what we saw in verse 4. Not only does God vigilantly watch over you without sleeping, but he's right beside you. So he watches when we sleep, but as we're hiking through life, he's
right beside us. Some interpreters imagine the Lord walking with the pilgrim on the journey to Jerusalem, shielding them from the blazing heat. And that might be part of the picture, but it likely goes deeper because ancient warriors held their shields in their left hand. And so their right side is the exposed side, and that's where God places himself. By being on the right side, he's covering your vulnerability, standing in the gap where you're most at risk. It's not just a general shelter. It's not just a tent. It's a targeted, covenantal, loving defense. In verse 6, he continues to expand this assurance. And he says, the sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. And this pairing of opposites, like the sun and moon, day and night, is another example of this mirrorism. It's this literary device that uses the two extremes to communicate totality. The message is this, that at all times, in all conditions, God's protection is present. There's no time of day or season of life that his watchful care is absent. That word strike is a military term, and it has these military overtones that God is not passive, but he's actively shielding his people from harmful blows. Whatever the pilgrim faces, whether the obvious dangers of the sun or the more mysterious and hidden ones of the moon, the Lord absorbs and deflects what could destroy. His protection is not partial, it's total, continual, and deeply personal. You know, when it's 114 degrees outside, you probably shouldn't go hiking. But that's where our family was, in Israel, in the middle of the record heat wave. We planned a short hike, but we made several mistakes. We started too late in the day. We got the distances wrong. We went in the wrong direction, and to top it off, we didn't bring enough water. And so about halfway through the hike, we're climbing over some ruins. This was the next day, so we were on Wednesday. On Thursday, it got 112, but it was 114 the day before, and sorry, William, I should have checked with you, bud. He falls. And he smashes into some ruins that ruined him. And we thankfully were able to find this tree. We got down this big old tree. We got down and we got repositioned. And the problem was that our car and its safety was about 2 miles away. And about this time, Christy, who didn't, I don't think she ate breakfast that day, she all of a sudden is starting to get a little fainty. And William is in no position to walk. The rest of them, look at Lily. She's thrilled, isn't she? And so the guide and I, we were going to hike and go get the car, but then the guide went about 200-300 meters and said, I just don't think I can make it. And so I took this half bottle of water, and I start this two-mile hike and this multi-mile trek in brutal heat with just my bottle of water and my watch tracking my heart rate. I found this week. I'm pumped that Garmin keeps these things for so long. The heat was relentless. I mean, the sun's pressing down. I just feel my energy draining away. I mean, I was actually, the second half, that last mile, I'm going from shade point to shade point. My water's done. I'm just looking for any patch of shade, a wall, a tree, a rock. I wasn't just trying to stay cool. It's like, I'm trying to stay conscious. I mean, you can watch. I mean, this is us going on the hike to start. Somebody falls down. Better check them out. Oh, no, we better get down from that little ruin and go find a tree. Okay, what are we going to do now? I'm going to go hiking. I mean, you can see my heart rate. Every time that it start getting up and my watch is going, beep, 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 you better stop. I'm like, okay, and I find somewhere and I rest and I go and I rest and I go and I rest and I go. And you can see all of the exertion there below. And then eventually I see the car. And you know what? That last long uphill before the car, when I reached the car, I opened the door. The wave of heat from that car sitting in 100 whatever just blazes my face. I turn on the air conditioning. I find a leftover liter of water. It's almost boiling. I'm drinking. I don't care. I'm just drinking. I've got my face right in the air conditioner. There I am. And eventually I begin to recover. You see, that day I didn't want shade. I needed shade. There's the difference between endurance and collapse. I get the car and I have to drive 15 miles out, and I'm driving through some pretty rough areas. And these park rangers are going in a car the other way, and they're like, here I am, it's just me in Israel. I'm just me in Israel. And these four guys go and they go, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. And we eventually get back over here and they patch up William, and we gotta take him, and he's gotta go get stitches. But the need for shade was not really optional. Psalm 121, 5 and 6. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. This isn't just poetic fluff. It's survival language. What he's saying, when the heat of life presses down on you and you're exposed and you're exhausted and you're not sure which way to go, he says, I will be right there with you. I will be your shade. He's describing himself not as a bonus feature. He's describing himself as what is essential for endurance. And the hike just reminds me, and this is probably why I found myself just getting a little bit emotional as we're singing the songs, because this congregation, we need the shade of God. Maybe you're not hiking through the desert, but maybe your body is breaking down. The wear and tear of age, pain, fatigue makes even the simple things feel like mountains. Maybe it's not the heat of the sun, but the weight of anxiety, grief, despair. It's bearing down. Your soul feels thin, brittle, ready to crack. Maybe it's not lost in the wilderness, but the silence in your marriage or the absence of someone you love feels like wilderness all of its own. Maybe it's not stress. Maybe it's not just internal, but you actually feel the pressure from outside, from a ministry or a work. You're pouring yourself out, but you feel empty. Maybe it's not the skin that's burning, but the cash is. You're doing the math, and it just doesn't add up. Maybe your heart is dry because heaven's been quiet. You've been reading the word, you're praying, but it feels like God is not showing up. Maybe the heat you face is watching a child struggle spiritually, physically, or emotionally, and you feel powerless. Maybe no one around you knows how fragile you feel. You're walking through shame and fear or temptation, feeling exposed when nobody else sees it. You didn't expect life to be this hard, but you're in it, and you need shade. The Lord does not promise a life free from heat, but he does promise his presence in the middle of it. He reminds us that the same God who made the sun also stands between it and you. The same God who rules the night also keeps watch when it feels dark and uncertain. He's your keeper. He's your shade. He's not distant. He's right beside you, and he guards you forever. That's the fourth point. Walk confidently. You see, your keeper guards your life now and forever. The final two verses of Psalm 121 brings the journey to this climactic assurance. God's commitment to your care extends across your entire life, both now and forever. That's what he's saying in those two verses. The Lord, verse 7, the Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. That Hebrew word for evil, it refers to outward calamities, inward sufferings, the consequences, whether they're because of your sinful choices or somebody else's sinful choices. But I, if you're a skeptic like me, you're reading a psalm and something's not right. What is it? What's going on with those of us that are a little bit more doubty? We find ourselves saying this, there's way too many bows in this one. Like this doesn't match how I feel. This doesn't match my life. This doesn't match what I see. How can the psalmist claim that we're kept from all evil when the rest of the songs of ascent and all of scripture and all of life around me affirm that God's people experience real pain? You tell me, psalmist. Just turn on the news. Bullets, rockets, plane crashes. We don't have to look too far to see the presence of evil. Natural disasters, injustice, relational fractures, spiritual darkness. And you almost feel like you got one up on the psalmist, and you tell the psalmist, just look around, and the psalmist looks at you, and they're not even rattled, and he just looks at you and says, exactly. You see, the psalmist doesn't promise the journey will be easy or hazard-free. In fact, the understanding Psalm 121 in its original contextual playlist, I mean, just plug and play the 15 psalms, and it makes it more applicable to our lives today. The road to Jerusalem was long, dangerous, and exposed. The pilgrims were exposed to injury, theft, exhaustion, and spiritual doubt. And similarly, our journey towards a faithful obedience in a broken world is full of hardship. But the point of the psalm is this, that we don't always know how God will protect us. We could be confident that he does. You see, so Psalm 121 doesn't deny difficult experiences. It includes them. The psalmist acknowledges the risks of slipping feet, the dangerous terrain, the exposure to the elements, the real evil. He actually wants us to understand that walking with God and walking toward God is never without trials. It's not a peaceful Zen stroll down a garden path. It's a rugged journey through a hostile world, and yet God is sovereign over it all. The content of verse 7 doesn't mean the absence of all difficulty, but rather protection from ultimate harm. And then in verse 8, he reinforces the scope of his protection with another A to Z mirrorism. Like this, let's talk about both extremes. And so he says, the pairing of the extremes to imply totality, the Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. In other words, every action, every movement, every season of life are under God's watchful care. It just includes a long list of things like your travels, your routines, your transitions, your beginnings, and your endings. And the language is this total lifelong journey when you set out on this pilgrimage. And he says, not only will you get there, but you'll make it safely home. He's like, there's this unshakable assurance God will see you there and back again. This raises a hard theological tension. If God has the power to prevent evil, if God has the power to protect me, why does he allow evil to touch me? For many, this becomes emotionally and spiritually disorienting. The psalmist does not give simplistic answers. Instead, he actually rejects the false dilemma that says God must either prevent all suffering or he's not good. The psalmist in Psalm 121, he offers a third way. You see, God intervenes in such a way that even though suffering comes, it cannot undo us. Even though the path is hard, your foot will not slip outside his sovereign care. You know, there are worse things than unemployment. There are worse things than betrayal or loss. I'm walking through a journey with one of my best friends who's got stage 4 liver cancer. And he just got a meh report. And they just threw everything at it. I mean, it was like all sorts of treatments, like a cocktail of 7 different kinds of chemo and and all sorts of other like add-on treatments. And he gets this report back after months of fighting this stage four liver cancer. And basically, I mean, the best that anyone can do, it just kind of stayed it in some areas, and in other ways it got worse. It doesn't look good. And I texted him. I said, "Hey, I'm preaching Psalm 121." I said, "Is there anything worse in life than cancer?" And without even skipping a beat, he just texts back. He goes, "Life without Jesus, walking away from grace, a wasted, pointless life, success without God, all of those are worse than cancer." You see, what the psalmist is saying is that God will guard you. He'll protect you from ultimate harm. He will not lose you. You see, the New Testament echoes this time and forevermore language that's found in verse 8. Jesus prays to the Father in John 17. He says, "While I was with them," this is his high priestly prayer. This is right before he dies on the cross for our salvation. He says, "While I was with them, I kept them in your name, which you have given me." And then I love this. He said, "I have guarded them." The language implies deliberate protective care. Jesus guarded his disciples during his ministry, and now he entrusts them to the Father's ongoing protection. I mean, here he is. He knows he's going to die. He's going to be resurrected. He's going to ascend into heaven. And then he says this, I do not ask that you take them out of this world, but that you keep them from the evil one. Jesus doesn't pray for escape, but for preservation. That's a comfort. That's the comfort in Psalm 121. Not that life will be painless, but you'll never be unguarded. God will see you there and back again. The story "There and Back Again" was written by the Hobbit Bilbo Baggins. Actually, that's the subtitle of The Hobbit, the classic fantasy novel by J.R.R. Tolkien. In The Lore of Middle Earth, Bilbo is both the main character, excuse me, and within the fictional world, he's the author of the tale. And he writes of his adventures. I hope every child here has read this story. Come on. Beginning with the peaceful Shire, and then the lonely mountain, and then with Thorin Oakenshield and the company of the dwarves, facing trolls, goblins, Gollum, and finally the dragon, Smaug. And then they return home again. And there's Bilbo. He writes the phrase, "There and back again." It just captures the full arc of this unexpected adventure. Bilbo wasn't going anywhere. He likes the Shire, and somehow he's dragged across Middle Earth, and he departs, and there's danger, but he comes back. And for the Christian, we can be assured that God will get us there and back again. We've all passed long road trips singing silly songs, but the Psalms of one of ascent and this Psalm of 121, they carry far more weight. Their playlist has so much more value. These songs of sacred affirmations remind the people of God who God is and what he thinks about them and who they are in light of his promises. And the Psalms, they form their hearts, they shape their worldview, they point their minds towards heaven as they journey towards Jerusalem. And so Psalm 121 invites every pilgrim, "So where does my help come from?" And then they're to boldly declare, "My help comes from the Lord." It reminds the people of God, they'll never walk alone. The one who shaped the mountain walks right by them. He's their keeper. He's their constant companion. And this assurance, it just frees us to take bold steps of faith. It's like Moses before Pharaoh and David before Goliath and Paul singing in prison. They just know that the presence of danger does not mean the absence of God. Paul whispers to it when Romans 8 verse 39, "Nothing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus the Lord." Can I just give us some affirmations? If you belong to the Lord, you are safe in his care. Your mountains may be high, but your maker is higher. Your problems may feel overwhelming, but his protection is constant. Your wounds may be deep, but his help is deeper still. So whatever hills you face, whatever path lies ahead, lift up your eyes. Your help comes from the Lord. And so let's do what the psalmist did. I'm going to ask you again, where does my help come from? And I want all of us to respond out loud, my help comes from the Lord who made the heaven and the earth.